Here we go.
Neutron, proton, mass defect, lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, transuranium, if you're always uranium, molecules, spontaneous combustion, pow! Law of definite proportion, gain ink weight, I'm every element around. Lead, gold, tin, iron, platinum, zinc. When I rap, you think iodine, nitrate, activate. Right, geranium, the only difference is I transmit sound. Balance with some balance, then you add a little talent in. Careful, careful with those ingredients. They can explode and blow up if you drop them and they hit the ground.
Welcome to Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. I'm Regina Barber DeGraff, astrophysicist, educator, Washingtonian, and naturally curious person.
And I am Jordan Baker, human at large, scuba diver, professional comedian, and also a naturally curious person. Joining us today is Dr. Kevin Covey, an astronomer from Western Washington University.
Yeah, and he is also my colleague at Western and has an office down the hall, and we've decided to watch the movie Interstellar. I teach Astronomy 103, and in the last two quarters, I've been asked if I've seen the movie Interstellar. I don't even know how many times. How many times have you been asked, Kevin?
Probably like four or five.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's...
It's common.
Yeah, it's
a lot lower.
You're right. I exaggerated. It might have been five. No, I'm sure it was more than that. But so I'd never seen it, and we decided to watch it yesterday, actually, Jordan and I. How did you like it, Jordan?
I put myself through it, you know. I made it all the way through the predictable storyline.
Yes. Well, I think what Jordan's referring to is that the one scene where
because I predicted the little girl was going to jump out of the blanket,
right? And that got big laughs. Yeah. It wasn't a comedic movie though, so there wasn't a lot of jokes.
Besides the robots, the sarcastic robots.
Oh my lord! Yes. So we'll get to all these things, and before we do, I'd like to welcome Kevin. Thank you for taking your time to come talk to us. He's laughing at me.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
But I wanted to talk to you about kind of backstory. Why did you become an astronomer? Why do you study astronomy?
I study astronomy because, I guess if you go all the way back, because I was on the high school newspaper.
Were you really?
I was.
Journalism?
Yeah. I was doing journalism, and I enjoyed particularly like the photo editing part of being on the school paper. And so when I went to college, I was starting to get interested in, I was majoring in physics and taking a bunch of physics classes. And the department kind of published a list of research projects that they were looking for students to participate in. And there was an astronomer who published a project that said, well, we're going to look at images of galaxies and identify the regions where stars are forming. And I was like, oh, I know Photoshop. Like, I am all over this. And so I went to visit the professor, and she was very kind. And she was like, oh, that's great. You're not going to use Photoshop at all. But, you know, we're going to look at a lot of pictures. And so I'm sure that that's going to translate. And so let's get started.
Wow.
And so very quickly she deflected from, like, this – why I thought I was going to be a good astronomer into just getting into the work. And more I've done the work, the more I've just enjoyed it. It's a really fun, really interesting kind of thing to do.
So what year in college was this?
This must be when I was a sophomore. I want to say sophomore.
And you still do research with star-forming regions, right?
I do. Yeah. In our own galaxy. At this point, we can't – though where I study star formation, we can't actually look at the entire galaxy and pick out individual star-forming regions because I study it closer to home. I'm interested in how stars like the sun formed in their earliest precocious years.
Yeah, no, I think it's your story of, like, your advisor kind of taking what you're interested in science and then kind of – guiding you to what science actually is basically what we're going to talk about today, right? People love astronomy. People love these science movies, and not everything in the movies is accurate or scientific, but at least they have that spark of interest, and we can guide them to actual science. At least that's, I don't know, my goal. What's your goal, Jordan?
you said star formation. It's, just to be clear, it's actually how they were formed, not the what are those things called? The Scorpion and Orion.
Right, not constellations.
Not constellations.
Absolutely.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That is
right.
A very good clarification. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. No, so I'm interested in their, how the stars, each individual star, how they came to be as like an object, not the formations they make in the sky.
Cool.
Good call.
Right.
Which I'm glad you brought up constellations, though, because
Tell me why.
Yeah, I had like prompted Jordan. I was like talking about misconceptions about astronomers. And as an astronomer, I guess I'm an astronomer, too. So I always get questions about, like, you know, constellations and, like, you know, meteor showers and stuff like that. And a giant misconception is that we know everything about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any other misconceptions, though, about astronomers other than that we know everything about constellations and the zodiac. We can tell horoscopes.
Right.
Yeah. I would say the zodiac and Mercury retrograde or whatever that is.
Right. And also that we actually look through a telescope.
Right.
That's also a big one that used to be an important way of which, you know, astronomers would actually study the universe.
You guys don't actually have telescopes?
No.
We have telescopes. We just don't actually put our eye to them very often.
So we'll be talking about the Hubble Space Telescope later.
Deception.
Yeah.
We're just giant liars. The Hubble Space Telescope is in space, right? So us as astronomers, we don't physically go up there and look through it. But there is data that is sent to us directly from the Hubble Space Telescope and maybe analyzed and modified before we get the data. But yeah, I've only actually been to two observatories like in my life. So yeah, I don't know. Do you go observing a lot? Do you have like... Do you actually physically go to the observatories that much to get your data?
Not too much. More often, yeah. Right now, I have not been to – when was the last time? Before I came to Western, I worked at an observatory. And so there I did actually go to the telescope kind of like once every month or two. So when I was at Lowell, I was going to use the telescope physically fairly often. While I've been at Western, more often I've been using, I think I've used kind of twice, maybe three times, telescopes elsewhere. But telescopes in Hawaii, telescopes in New Mexico, I can use from my office here in Bellingham just by
remotely,
essentially, you know, using the power of the internet to control the telescope, to tell it exactly what stars I want to point at and go. And then I get a digital camera image, very much off a device, very much like the camera in our phones these days. So I can use those telescopes without going to them. So I still do conduct observations, but
right. It's
not nearly as interesting or romantic. It means it's like being in your office
sadly.
At 3 a.m. in Bellingham.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people don't understand that like when you actually go to the observatory, you aren't looking through the telescope. Like it's all automated and it's all digital and it's, you know, you're sitting in front of a screen, of a computer screen. So the only two times that I've done this, that's what it was like.
Right.
I don't know. When you think of astronomers, Jordan, other than that we all look through telescopes and we know constellations, is there anything else that kind of comes to mind? No. I guess you know me, so it's kind of like it's a loaded question, right? I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, I never owned a telescope as a kid. I don't own a telescope now. I am not an amateur astronomer. I think there's a difference between people that – you know, are astrophysicists that go through it, that take data with these large telescopes versus star parties and amateur astronomers, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that's not what I've done.
Right. And when I was growing up, I think Halley's Comet came by when I was like 10 or 12 or something. And so my mom got me like a small, you know, telescope, glass lenses, like 2 inches across. And, I mean, I was growing up in Portland, Oregon, too, very Pacific Northwest kind of weather. So a clear night is also pretty rare to come by. So I think the number of times I use that telescope to actually look, you know, at anything, particularly in the sky, I could probably count on one hand.
Right. That's a really good point. Like, I mean, Jordan and I also grew up in Whatcom County, right? I mean, when do we have time to actually see stars and not have it be super cloudy and not being horribly cold or wet or like, yeah. So it's... No wonder I didn't like telescopes. It's all coming back now.
Yeah.
All right. So aside from that, aside from these misconceptions, so there were these in the movie. Let's get to the movie. Let's get to Interstellar.
Let's.
First of all, the very beginning of the movie, She's talking about this. Spoiler alert. Let's stop this right now. I mean, we're going to go through the movie. We're going to be talking about the plot and the ending. So if anyone's listening and has not heard this movie.
Sorry.
Here's your opportunity to like turn the radio down.
Yes.
Turn it off. Or watch just, the movie. Come back.
Or just listen to us and then watch the movie and have it spoiled for you. That's fine. But so the very beginning when she's like, there's this ghost in my room. I don't know if you remember this. Yeah, it's like the main plot, right? My husband was like, this better not be an M. Night Shyamalan movie. That was like his like, is everyone going to be a ghost and is everyone going to be dead? But other than that, there's the misconception at the very, very beginning of like that there wasn't a lunar landing. That this girl gets in this fight with these other kids that, you know, of course, like it's not only crazies that don't believe in that we didn't land on the moon. It's like the administration, like the education system now no longer believes in NASA and that we actually went to the moon.
Right. Well, in the world of that movie, there's clearly this way in which and this is all embedded within this post-apocalyptic kind of scenario in which like crops are failing. And so a lot of what we think of as modern technology and science has kind of has failed this civilization and society.
And giant, chunky laptop.
Yeah. Yeah. And like this drone, like in the early part of the movie,
right?
They chase this drone that has apparently just been flying kind of unmanned.
Right. And that was crazy.
Five or tens of years.
Yeah. I not run into anything while it was unmanned forever?
Right. So I think that the official kind of story or the widespread belief that the moon landings were faked is part of this larger sense of all of society having kind of lost faith in science and technology as something that actually is beneficial and useful.
Right. But I did want to bring up like something about the moon, though, because I really find that interesting because the whole their civilization not believing in this moon landing anymore kind of makes me think of like that seems ridiculous to a lot of people, but – even understanding like the phases of the moon or like seasons, which we were talking about at work, and like that, like the dark side of the moon, and all these things that are that can be viewed, can be actually observed every night. People still don't understand that right now. So, and there are people that still don't believe we went to the moon. So, I wanted to take a second and talk about those moon misconceptions before we continue with Interstellar.
Please do.
Okay. I don't know. So what is, like, the biggest moon misconception that you've encountered, like, as an educator or as an astronomer? I think I've alluded to a few, I guess.
Yeah. I think the biggest – I don't know if I would just call it a misconception. Is it a misconception? Maybe. I mean, there's the misconception that there is a dark side of the moon, right?
Right.
That there is a part of the moon that is permanently – encased in darkness, and that's
I blame Pink Floyd for
and
that.
That's yeah,
so not just an album.
Yeah.
It's untrue.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so to explain is like there isn't a dark side.
Right.
There is a side of the moon that does face Earth all the time, but that doesn't mean that there is one side that's always dark all the time.
Right. So it's one of these things where it's mixing, you know, something that is true, which is there's a side of the moon that we can't see. And it's also the case that during a certain time of month, right, the moon becomes dark. So half of the moon is always dark, but it's built off of these two things that are true in isolation, and then it mixes them together to make this misunderstanding that there's a half of the moon that we can't see and that which is always dark.
Right.
And that combination never happens. And that's mixed in with kind of broader lack of clarity about what's causing the actual phases of the moon, right? Thinking that it's the shadow of the Earth falling on the moon that causes the phases.
Which it is not.
Which it is not,
okay.
No.
Tell us what it is. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know this.
Right. So the part of the moon that we can't see at any given phase is the dark side of the moon at that point, right? And so the fact that we sometimes see a very narrow crescent moon, and so we're seeing a large part of the moon that's dark, is
Which means and the other side is lit.
Which means, yeah, is part of why it means the other side is lit up and so not permanently in dark.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting. And it's at Western, we have a lab that you have these, like, styrofoam balls and you have this big, bright light, kind of like the ones we have in the studio here. and you have these students and they walk around the light and you can see that it's the sun that's making the moon be lit, and it's the shadow where the sun isn't hitting where you get these dark parts of the moon. So it's not the Earth's shadow that's making the phases of the moon. It's whichever area is lit by the sun is making the phases of the moon as it's like going around. So
I have some teachers that I have to write some notes to.
Right.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein.
This is Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KMRE-LP 102.3 FM in Bellingham, broadcasting from the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention on Bay Street.
Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, and may God's love be with you.
What was your overall, like, what's your overall rating of this movie, Kevin? And then I'll talk about mine.
My overall rating of Interstellar?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, on a scale, like, how? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Yeah, I don't know. Should we, Ebert?
I give it a full-on meh. Like,
yeah.
I like Christopher Nolan's movies a lot, and so I had went. So I find that often my impression of a movie, right, is very strongly related to what I expected going in.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
So if I go in and see a movie that's kind of middling, but I thought it was going to be horrible, I'm like, come out, and I'm like, that's amazing. And so with Christopher Nolan, like, I loved Memento. I thought, you know, the beginning, Batman Begins, was like,
yeah, that was
amazing.
That's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's always started really high for me, and so his more recent movies have tended to disappoint me because I'm hoping he'll recapture that initial magic. And so this was one where I think, you know, he did not live up to his previous movies for me. And I found that was because it partially was this – it was very ambitious, both in terms of the way in which it was trying to incorporate science and also I think what he wanted to kind of communicate at something about humanity and –
like
individuals, yeah, like the motivation that motivates us as individuals and species and the role that love plays in that. And so it was a very big movie with lots of things it was trying to make happen, and so I think it struggled to pull off.
It's kind of like the show. We're trying to do so many things.
Struggle to pull it off.
Yeah, no, it is. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, like, my expectations of movies totally kind of frame how I'm going to leave the movie, how I'm going to feel. A terrible example of that is that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle animated movie that came out, what was that, like 8 years ago, 10 years ago? I don't know. I'm old, so.
Yeah.
I don't know. I went into that thinking it was going to be horrible, and it wasn't.
So,
but yeah, I have very low expectations, and I've been trying to do that from now on. I just thought that the whole movie was very slow. Like, I mean, it was just a very slow kind of running movie, and I think me, just personally, I need more comic relief than the robots could give, you know?
Yeah.
And they tried. I mean, they, God love them, you know, they're, they're like, they looked like handcrafted, like, Transformers that people made for Halloween and then, like, made silver. It was, oh, man. I love robots,
I mean, they weren't even
too.
Transformers. They were, like, four chopsticks.
Right.
Like,
right.
Tied together.
I was so
I didn't so understand at all why. Like,
they
could, who
they
would
could run with a human in their arms, though.
Right.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, they turn into, like, wheel things.
Right. Like, they were, like, not cool for 90% of the time. And then, like, 10%, they were, like, amazing.
Right.
Right. I was so disappointed. Our next show is going to be talking to computer scientists. So, I mean, this, for our listeners, me talking about how disappointed about these robots I was is going to continue probably for a week. I think to myself, like, why do I avoid astronomy-related movies? Because as a kid, I really liked Contact, but looking back on it as an adult, you know, we as astronomers don't listen to radio, we don't do radio astronomy with headphones, I guess is, which was in Contact, you know?
Right.
And the reason, like, a lot of astronomers don't watch these astronomy-related movies because it's, like, painful. It's painful sometimes to see the science you love kind of altered and twisted into something that it is not. But somebody just asked me, what did you think about Odyssey, Space Odyssey 2001.
I haven't watched that in a really, really long time.
Me neither.
It's funny, actually. The one thing that does come to mind in thinking about the robots is I do remember there was some scene where they were, like, in that kind of, like, very rectangular shape, and it reminded me of the monolith from 2001. And
yeah,
I thought that
it was
part of – I was wondering if it was an homage somewhere in there.
That makes complete sense now,
yeah.
Why those robots looked so lame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I haven't watched, actually, 2001 in quite some time.
I remember watching it my boyfriend at the time when I was 14, which is now my husband. Jordan knows him.
I do.
Yeah, I do. he had me watch that because he was like, you like astronomy? Let's watch 2001. And I remember that I'd watched a lot of movies before that. I'm a movie kid. And I had predicted most of the scenes that were going to happen. And he was like, how do you know this? And I was like, I've seen a lot of movies. But what I didn't realize as a kid is that so many movies have referenced that movie. You know, like you just pointed out, basically paid an homage to it. So, like, the reason I knew what was going to happen is because I had seen so many parodies or so many movies that kind of referenced it. And I didn't realize that until maybe my adulthood. I don't know. Have you seen 2001, Jordan?
I think your husband tried to get me to watch it one time,
and I was
just like, "Eh, I'm done."
I'm done. Yeah, because it also was slow. It was very Interstellar like. It's all coming back to me now. Like, it kind of followed the same progression of like you were talking about, like reflecting on human connections, reflecting on human emotions and family and love and also science.
And so. Killer robots.
And killer
computers.
Robots. HAL was great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, these robots in Interstellar were amazing. They were very dedicated to helping their
Yeah, they were
people.
At least helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't try and lock anyone
in. I liked them as their personalities. I just didn't like the way they looked. I'm just shallow. Mm. I think that's what it is. Do you ever avoid astronomy-related movies or like science-related movies just for the fear that it might turn out crappy?
No, I don't know. No, but I mean, I also don't. The corollary to that is that I don't actually go to them very often because I'm like, oh, this is going to be – like, I understand that, right, 2001 was not about astronomy. It was about, you know, a killer robot that was set in space.
Right.
And being set in space and being about either – astronomy as a science or even the kind of conducting astronomy as an astronomer,
right?
Which actually there are parts in like Contact, so the headphones is pretty bad.
So
but
bad.
There are parts where they actually show like the control room of the radio telescope they were using for that scene. And it's like the monitor is totally covered with sticky notes. And there's a lot of other things where it was like, oh no, that actually looks and feels a lot like, you know, how we actually end up doing our science, where it's like 4 a.m. and you're like, oh, I need to remember something. And so you put a sticky note right on front of the computer. So that was nice to see in Contact. But so my desire to see Contact was neither, like, I was not turned off by it.
Right.
But it's because I know that usually the science is not the motivating part of a lot of the movies that are set in space.
I think maybe the reason I avoid them is just because I like comedy movies. I think that's why it is. And it was not a comedy. All right, so I tried to rent Gravity, and I could not find it on the Redbox. I tried many things. I tried one thing. I went to the Redbox, and I couldn't find Gravity.
Right.
And I gave up.
Well, you tried two things. There was two Redboxes.
That's true.
Next to each other.
That's very true, Jordan.
But you tried.
I tried so hard.
Right. And I realized I tried to look it up last night on Netflix, and it's not on Netflix,
no.
But it is on HBO Go.
Yeah. I don't have the cables anymore.
Yeah.
It was so hard. I gave up cable for grad school, and it helped me not fail out of grad school. Mm. So
such a sacrifice.
It was a sacrifice. You have no idea, Jordan. As a child.
I don't.
Yeah, I love my cable. But so I wanted to talk about like this kind of relationship, Interstellar versus Gravity, and because those are the last two kind of major astronomy related movies that came out recently, and they got a lot of buzz. A lot of people have seen them. Jordan's seen Gravity. You've seen Gravity. So and I saw a synopsis. So I think we can talk about this. First of all, which one did you guys like better? Because you guys saw both of them and I didn't, so.
I liked Gravity, just for the storyline.
Yeah.
Based on the storyline alone.
Yeah, I liked Gravity better. And also, I mean, based on the storyline, which is partially just like, it's a really simple story, right? Like, the narrative message there is like, I'm in space and I'm screwed.
Yeah.
And I don't want to die.
Right.
Like, it's a pretty simple concept.
Like the last minute where, like, somebody can grab a, like, the edge of a cliff. They, like, perfected that in that movie. You were, like, gripping the armrest in the theater. Like,
yeah.
I'd watched somebody basically recap it on YouTube and talk about the scientific inaccuracies. And he was talking about how Sandra Bullock almost dies eight different times. Like, and, like, why do they keep on, like, doing this to her? Why does she have, like, a King Kong grip on in some scenes and, like, Butterfingers in another scene?
Mm, right.
So, yeah, that suspense. It's a very suspenseful movie. And unlike Interstellar, it was, like, really action-packed, right? Like, stuff happened, like, right after.
Yeah.
So, and I think, like, Kevin, you said that, like, Interstellar was this, like, kind of really complex, they're trying to get this big idea across, and Gravity was not.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were some big ideas, but it was, like, it was one. It was much simpler and more focused, whereas Interstellar just felt a lot more scattered.
Right, broad. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the science in either one of those, because us talking about 2001 and its similarities with Interstellar made me think about the artificial gravity that was created. Because in 2001, you had, you know, that rotating kind of space station, and they're trying to use, you know, basically inertia, as people are basically hitting the wall over and over and over again, as, like, replicating acceleration due to gravity.
Right.
But, like, I get questions all the time, like, why doesn't NASA do that? Why doesn't NASA do that? Like, and I don't have a really good answer. My only answer is, like, it would have to be really, really big, because to may have something rotate to simulate that kind of gravity, you'd either have something that was small going really, really fast, or you'd have something very big going at a reasonable speed. And making big things is expensive. But there was some other reason too. I don't know. Do you know of any, like, engineering reasons why?
I don't know of any engineering reasons. I mean, part of the other reason I would say is that one of what like the space station, one of the justifications for the space station is it allows you to do experiments in microgravity. So it allows you to take advantage of the fact that, you know, it seems like a gravity-free environment up there. And so actually creating a part of the space station that has gravity then will kind of remove your ability to do those experiments.
That's true.
So I'm not sure there's been a strong motivation to do it. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way.
This is Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KMRE LP 102.3 FM in Bellingham, broadcasting from the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention on Bay Street.
We had an astronaut on a previous show, and she had talked about exercising in space and stuff like that. So, I mean, they have ways to kind of counteract any bone deterioration that results from being in zero gravity. So,
but
why would you need gravity is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think in like 2001, right, they're doing it in the context of this, I guess the ship's going to Jupiter. Is that where they find? Oh,
yeah.
Which is also where they go in Interstellar. That's where the wormhole is.
No, that's
Saturn.
It's Saturn.
Oh,
it's
sorry.
Saturn.
Sorry.
It's close. Sorry. It's close.
Yeah, they're both gas giants.
Yeah.
It's easy to get them confused.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think in order to do long-term space travel, if you want human beings to be able to walk around on the planet whenever they get where they're going, that does mean you want to simulate gravity. But in the context where all we're doing right now is going back and forth to a space station. And you want people to be able to walk, but they're not staying there for more than a year at a time generally. You don't have that need.
Right.
And it's definitely a perk to go out into space and just float around.
Yeah.
I don't want to walk when I'm in space.
No,
I mean, I just want to float around and push buttons.
And it allows you to make really cool cover songs of Major Tom.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right. That was a recent video, right?
Yeah. Colonel Hadfield, I think. He's a Canadian, actually, astronaut in the International Space Station, made this pretty awesome cover of the David Bowie song.
Yes. I've watched that. Yeah. I didn't know it was
And he gets a lot of mileage out of, like, being able to take the guitar
and spin it.
And spin it. Yes. And actually have it just float in front of him.
So, I mean, this is a total aside, but have you read anything about how they did those, floating scenes? Did they go up in the Vomit Comet? Was it all CG? Was it, like, wires? Do you know?
What are we? We're not talking. I mean,
Interstellar.
Oh, in either Interstellar or okay. Gravity.
But not the YouTube movie.
Not
video.
No, the YouTube. That was actually in
space. Yeah, that's the coolest. They actually went to space and stuff was actually floating.
How did they do that? No. In the movies.
So I know that in Gravity. So Gravity was actually. It took about 4 years, I think, from start to finish to make that movie, and a large part of it was that they built some pretty elaborate rigs, and had to like block out shots so that people would appear weightless and would appear to be floating. So I think a lot of work went into suspending them, either with wires or with kind of mechanical struts that were very carefully placed where the camera wouldn't see them.
Oh, okay.
I don't know as much about Interstellar, but in Interstellar, there's not actually that many scenes where they're weightless, right? Like they're
going
they're on
the
planets.
In the very yeah. beginning, they're moving around a lot.
Yeah, right when they get to the space station and
right
before they turn on the gravity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but then they do turn on the gravity, and then they're on planets.
Right.
And
right.
so yeah.
So yeah, so that's what I was wondering. I know that when they were doing, I don't know, what movie was that? It was with Tom Hanks, the Apollo missions.
Apollo 13.
Yeah. Thank you, Jordan. Yeah, I mean, I know that they, or at least I had read somewhere that they had gone up in the Vomit Comet, you know, so they could actually film some of that stuff, or I could be totally wrong. Because there wasn't that many scenes in Interstellar that they had to, you know, move around looking like they're weightless. I wonder if they did go up in the Vomit Comet. I don't know. But if you had to, you would get, I mean, you'd do those scenes over and over and over again. You'd get so sick.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's called the Vomit Comet. So.
Yeah. Yeah, my guess is that they faked them from the ground.
Yeah.
If I had to go.
A little rig, a little CGI.
Yeah.
Clean it up.
Yeah. Probably. All right. So like, back to, like, science. Let's go back to science here. I wanted to talk about, like, the Hubble Space Telescope and, like, servicing missions to the Hubble Space Telescope. Because, like you said, simple idea for gravity. She has to go up there and put, you know, her instrument that she designed as a medical doctor.
Right.
Makes no sense.
No, that part didn't make much sense.
No.
Yeah. Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
And go up and service the Hubble Space Telescope. So I wanted to take this time to actually inform our listeners of, like, what is that? Like, does NASA actually go up, service the Hubble Space Telescope? How long has it been up there? You know, like, do other things need servicing? So let's talk about that.
Okay. So yes.
Yes.
NASA does. Oh, okay. NASA does service HST, and so that's one of those areas where I thought Gravity actually did a decent job of kind of creating the look and feel of the modern space program, and you know, building an action movie around it, but otherwise being fairly true to like the big picture of what it's like, and you know, why we're going to space, and what it's like when we get there. And so there have been, I think, 5 servicing missions to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's in what's called a low Earth orbit. And so at one point in Gravity, right, what's his name?
Clooney,
exactly. Clooney's like, okay, well, we've got 90 minutes to get to safety, which is very convenient. Like, that's exactly the time of a movie as well. It's like, we've got enough time to make one movie until to get to safety. But part of that is because the space shuttle and the space telescope are in one of these low Earth orbits that takes 90 minutes to orbit the Earth. And so the debris that had kind of clobbered the satellite and the shuttle was now going to spend the next 90 minutes wrapping around the Earth, but then it would be back. And so that was actually also kind of...
And it would fit a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's and awesome. It's a perfect running time for a modern movie. But there have been... So there we do go with the shuttle, or we have gone. There are currently no more plans in the last servicing mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. Was intended to be the last servicing mission, although that's not... I don't think that's the first time that's happened.
Right, that's happened before.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the first servicing mission was for the very old listeners who are as old as I am. You know, we can actually remember.
We're all the same age, Kevin.
The listeners might not be.
Oh, okay. Sorry. No. I thought we were talking about us.
No. I'm talking about our kind listeners who are much more youthful than some of us.
Maybe.
But so those of us who are older can remember, like, in the early 90s when the Hubble Space Telescope was launched, there was the mirror was ground to the wrong shape. It was essentially put on – they they cut one of the tests in order to make the launch happen on time, and that test ended up being a bad thing to cut because it would have shown that the mirror had the wrong shape, and so it didn't bring all of the light to focus in the correct way. And so the first servicing mission put in basically gave Hubble glasses to correct for this misshapen mirror that it had. That was in the early 90s. And since then, there have been a variety of other servicing missions to replace things like gyroscopes, right? I mean, if you think about it, it's like Hubble's as big as a bus. And so it'd be kind of amazing if you never had to take a school bus into the shop and fix it. And so there have been four or five missions to go up and replace various parts that have worn out.
And they also replace and change out cameras on the Hubble Space
Right. Sure, there's lots of updating, right?
Sometimes when you have money to update.
Yeah, but there have been that part of Gravity too, right? There have been several cameras that have – we are now on, like, I think the third or fourth generation of camera in the Hubble Space Telescope. So there are definitely astronauts who have to go up and who do very – and it is very dangerous work. Thankfully, we haven't actually lost any astronauts during doing a spacewalk or anything on a Hubble mission.
The kind of disaster that is depicted in Gravity has not happened.
No.
But you, I think listeners don't know about the other space telescopes, the other space recording, you know, data collection devices that are up there that aren't serviced.
Right.
So give me some examples because I don't have them in
my mind. Well, basically every other space telescope we've got up there. But let's see, what are ones that are near and dear to my heart? So there's the Chandra X-ray telescope, which is actually in a relatively – it's in a fairly close orbit too, but we've never sent a servicing mission up.
And how
Chandra.
Long has that been up?
It's been up since the mid-90s, so I think it's been up around 20 years. So Hubble recently went through, I think, its 25th anniversary. I think it was launched in 89. And Chandra went up in the kind of early mid-1990s. The Spitzer Space Telescope went up in the early 2000s, and it's in what's called an Earth-trailing orbit, which a lot of the other space telescopes go up in orbits that don't have their orbits centered on the Earth, like the Moon and the Hubble Space Telescope and the Space Shuttle. But they instead get put into these orbits where they're actually kind of orbiting the Sun, just like the Earth is. And so Spitzer's in this what's called an Earth-trailing orbit, so it's slightly behind us, and it's orbiting the Sun once every year, but in such a way that it's actually slowly drifting away from us. So its orbit around the Sun is slowly lagging ours. So it's getting farther.
Eventually, we'll run into it.
Eventually, it'll wrap around, but no, it won't. That won't actually happen. Thankfully, it won't crash into us. There's a weird dynamical interaction where once it starts to approach us from the other end, so once we've basically almost lapped it,
right,
we will start to give it energy gravitationally, and it'll start to move away from us again. It'll start to basically start to catch up with us again.
Hmm.
Yeah.
This is Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KMRE LP 102.3 FM in Bellingham, broadcasting from the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention on Bay Street.
What about Kepler, right?
Yeah, so Kepler's also in an Earth trailing orbit. So it's very similar.
We probably need to explain what Kepler is. I'll let you do that, Kevin.
Oh, right. Sorry. So Kepler is a satellite that was sent up, I believe it's about 6 years old now. I think it was launched in 2008. And it was a mission to identify other planets in our galaxy. And it did that by taking very, very detailed measurements of the brightnesses of stars and noticing when a star got fainter because a planet passed in between us and the star.
Like a solar eclipse.
Yeah, so like a solar eclipse in our solar system, but we were seeing solar eclipses in these other solar systems. So it also was in a similar kind of Earth trailing orbit to Spitzer.
Right, which totally brings me to another thing that I was kind of perturbed by in Interstellar, and it was, why are there planets, why would they go to planets around a black hole? Like, that was crazy, right? I mean, you talked about planet finding. So, yes, in astronomy, we do, astronomers spend time looking for planets in other solar systems and other, within our galaxy, not outside of our galaxy, which was what Interstellar did. And there's multiple ways, like you said, these light curves, we can look at these eclipsing. There's other ways, like the wobble of a star. Like our own sun feels forces from the planets around it. So if there's planets around extrasolar planets. Okay, I'm right. Okay, good. that these stars will like move just a little bit, wobble, and it's because there's something else pulling on them that we can't see. But anyway, my point is, why would we be going outside of our galaxy to find these habitable planets like in the movie? Why did we have to leave our galaxy for that? And two, why are the best options around a black hole? Did that not bother you, or is that just me?
Well, didn't they end up going there because that's where the wormhole took them?
Yeah, but like...
So they didn't have a chance, I mean...
No, I'm talking about the writers. I'm not talking about the aliens that put them there.
Yeah, I have no idea why the writers chose to do that. Other than, right, I take that back. My guess is that the writers chose to do it because they wanted to set up this kind of scenario in which...
they had to go inside a black hole. I mean,
well, and also that, like, that his daughter aged and, like, lived her life and,
right,
you know, the power of love for him to demonstrate his love for his daughter.
Right.
In a very odd way. Anyway, yeah.
We'll talk about time dilation and all that kind of stuff in a second. But before we do that, like, if we're talking about a black hole that's maybe created by a supernova, let's say, then why would there still be planets, like, just hanging out, you know? Like, how would they have not been, like, totally blown out? That bothered me a lot.
Yeah,
I
don't have a very good answer for you.
Yeah, and there's so many stars out there, right? There's so many stars that are like our sun that probably have planets, and yeah. I'll believe wormholes, and I'll believe that, you know, gravity waves. Actually, I won't. But that really bothered me. Like, why? Why would planets be around black holes? But anyway, I'll stop my hate for the robots and that too. But yeah, so I think a lot of people ask me about, you know, time dilation when we're talking about black holes and all that stuff. So, do you ever talk about that in your astronomy classes?
Yeah, I talk about it. I mean, I talk about it a little. I talk more about black holes. I don't get as much into, like, time dilation and special relativity type of stuff, because I think black holes are, like, a nice bridge where you can use some of what you understand about how gravity works, and you can kind of, like, push it to the limit.
Right.
Whereas I think the more extreme effects, like how different people perceive time, takes away that kind of connection to your intuition.
So you're saying intuition of like this bending of space that black holes are doing, I guess we could say that. This idea of gravity as a concept with space-time and like orbits are really like mapping out the bending of space. That is more interesting, you're saying, and more intuitive than talking about time dilation, is what you're
saying. Yeah, I think once, particularly in the context of a kind of an introductory astronomy class where you end up usually talking about like planets and orbits and whatnot, it's a lot easier to kind of help people think about what happens now if you take the central object in that system and just turn its mass up to 11, you know, and like how does that behave? It allows people to start with something they've practiced and then use the intuition that they've developed for how gravity works and see how it works in an extreme scenario. Whereas I think it's very hard to get to the same place with a lot of the time dilation effects that happen when you bend space-time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have not had a adequate astronomy course as an astronomer talking about time dilation related to it related to bending of space. I mean, I've had a class that talks about like as you're traveling near the speed of light, then time, you know, is dilated, feels like it slows down. Talking about physically traveling at those speeds, I think, is somewhat easier than talking about how time is warped when space is warped as well. I would not be able to do that.
Right.
But that seems to be the questions I get.
Yeah, which, and it's understanding because, right, as and as human beings, and this is why I think they did enjoy having a black hole to play with in Interstellar, right, is because it allows you to kind of think about what it would be like if you could avoid or work around what, you know, seems like in our usual day-to-day experience, the inevitable progression of time. And so you can create lots of interesting narrative possibilities if you're able to invoke these very extreme effects that, you know, work either in very extreme, very particular environments that may or may not actually, you know, be conducive to humans surviving when they pass through a wormhole. Like, although it's mathematically possible to have these kind of time temporal effects happen, that makes it very tempting for creating a narrative.
Right.
Yeah, and it's easy to add a whole lot of stuff to a big unknown of, like, what's on the other end of it. Wormhole or black hole or whatever. Are they the same thing, wormhole and black hole? Or
so, go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, well, I was going to say, so this is not an area of my kind of like direct expertise, but I believe a black hole does not have to be a wormhole. So all wormholes have to involve black holes. But a wormhole is a special kind of black hole where the way in which the curvature of space happens means that a effectively, the two ends of the black hole are separated in our space time.
But are connected to each other.
But are connected to each other. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're not necessarily the same.
Yeah. Not every wormhole has a black hole, but not every black hole is a wormhole.
Like all oranges are fruit, but not all fruit are oranges.
Mm. Tasty.
This is Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KMRE LP 102.3 FM in Bellingham, broadcasting from the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention on Bay Street.
It was very pretty, though.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. And it was actually, so that's one where that's not my area of expertise professionally, but I got curious enough that I read up a little about the way in which they actually made those images of the black hole. Gargantua is what they call it in Interstellar.
Wow. Yeah, I that slightly annoyed me too. I don't know. Like, we're just going to name this specific.
Well, they're going to it, right? Like,
yeah, that's
you
true.
Want to
that's
say,
true.
Like, oh, I'm going to Fred Meyers. Like, right. You want to have a name for where you're going. So, Gargantua, you know, it's
okay.
Big.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to that big store.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, continue.
No, that's okay. Yeah, so, but the visualization of that black hole is based off of a pretty detailed and pretty accurate calculation of what you would actually expect to see near a black hole. And where it was done with enough detail and enough accuracy that where it's actually wrong, it was often, at least as they explained in the paper about this calculation of these images, they did it for artistic reasons. Essentially, they said, well, we're gonna make this black hole, which we need to have certain properties to explain the time dilation they wanted the astronauts to experience on, I can't remember the name of the world, but like that little
Hoth.
Ocean. It was not Hoth. I didn't see any Tauntauns.
Yeah.
Do they live on Hoth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so they wanted a world. They wanted time dilation to work in such a way that 1 hour was 1 year, right? And so that dictated certain properties of the black hole that world needed to be orbiting.
Right, and where the event horizon was, and all that kind of stuff.
Right, and so then they started a simulation of that, and they said, "Oh, that looks too funky." And so they actually like dialed back its properties from what was totally necessary to explain the time dilation that happens on that world in the movie, so that visually the people watching the movie would still think of like, that's kind of what I would expect a black hole to look like.
Yeah.
So areas where that black hole is wrong. So for instance, the black hole actually has to be spinning.
Well, yeah.
And they reduced its rotation rate, because if it were spinning, as fast as it would need to be to explain the time dilation properly, then half of it would be approaching us so quickly that the light, the effective wavelength of the light coming from us would change. So half of it would be bluer and half of it would be redder.
Awesome.
And they thought, oh, this is – and it would actually turn out that also the blue half would be bright and the red half would be fainter. And so then you get this really strong kind of like shading across the black hole, and the colors change, and so it would make it look really psychedelic.
So they consciously said,
"We're going to make it spin as fast as we can without making that color effect too."
I agree with you that black holes are amazing. Like just like the density of like neutron stars and white dwarfs. I mean, all of that is awesome, and I totally understand why people like it.
But that's a really good example, I think, of like. The difference between then what – I mean, that I found very, very fascinating. How much screen time did that thing get?
A lot.
Yeah.
Really? No. I thought that the black hole
– I think it got a lot.
Maybe 10 minutes maybe, the whole thing.
There was not 10 minutes of screen time
Black
hole.
Oh, that's got to be 10 minutes.
Yeah. Please, somebody look
that up. I will battle you for 10 minutes.
We're arm wrestling.
Maybe that's what we remember. Maybe it didn't have that much screen time. I don't know. This is all like human memory.
Because I thought when I actually ended up watching it, because I read all this stuff about how they calculate it, and then I watched it, and I was like, I mean, they show like the spaceship orbiting it a little bit, but I would have been surprised if that thing got more than a minute of on-screen time.
I will also battle you. It definitely got more than a minute, but it didn't. I don't know.
I had a couple of beers, and I don't know.
So I was super stoked about that and seeing the black hole part. And I was like, oh, all of this stuff, which I learned all this interesting science about, and I was disappointed at how much time.
Well, I mean, it does make me, I mean, a little happy, too, that they spent that much time to try to make it as accurate as they possibly could, other than why would planets be around the black hole? But trying to make it, you know, look accurate, that does make me feel good. And I mean, like, it's Interstellar isn't the only place that does this. I mean, when we were talking about the moon and faking moon landings and, you know, if it's real or not, I think the Big Bang Theory did an episode talking about shooting a laser to the moon and, you know, to see how far it is away. And those you know, experiments actually do happen, you know. So... And the light reflects off of reflectors on the moon, which astronauts had to put up there. So we did go to the moon, just to clarify for everybody.
Right.
Hollywood has gotten maybe, I don't know, better. I don't know. We're young. I don't know. I don't know if it's gotten better or not. But there are the things that slightly don't make sense, like...
Well, the whole like ending of the movie.
Oh my God, gravity waves!
That's where he was playing the universe like a harp to send messages to his, you know, his earlier self and his daughter.
Well, what?
That part.
How did they know it was called the Tesseract?
They made it up.
Well,
right?
No, but as so Matthew McConaughey, I feel so bad. Like Matthew McConaughey is always Matthew McConaughey to me. Like it's. But as he was doing that, like he was like talking about the Tesseract, and I think Tars was telling him that. And I'm like, how does he know that it's named the Tesseract? And why do they keep on talking about gravity as like an entity? They just keep on being like, well, that's gravity. And I was like, as a physics professor, you know, you always say like the force due to gravity or acceleration due to gravity, and they just kept on saying gravity, which kind of really, really bugged me. But yeah, the gravity wave things. Gravity waves are real, though. So, like, I mean, I think we owe it to our listeners to explain as best we possibly can. You know, what are gravity waves and how does that tie into any sort of reality that they were trying to say?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a gravity wave is, it's
We haven't detected them yet.
Yeah, we have not detected them yet. We are looking for them. There's an experiment in eastern Washington near the Hanford Reservation or former nuclear site.
Yeah.
Where they've got what's called an interferometer. So they've got a very precise – they're using a laser beam to measure the distance between these two mirrors or four mirrors actually, very, very precisely. And so what they're looking for is actually to see the distance between those mirrors change slightly, which would indicate that the the properties of space between those mirrors have actually changed because of the way in which space gets bent by mass moving through the universe. And so if we have two really, really heavy or really dense objects, two black holes, two neutron stars, which are these very, very massive, they're essentially like atoms the size of Manhattan.
Manhattan. That's always the city that astronomers use. Manhattan.
Yeah, Manhattan Island.
Yeah.
So if you have those objects, right, each of those objects are so dense and so massive that they're bending space around them. And so now if you take those objects and actually put them in motion, the way in which they're bending space is going to change. And that change is going to then move away and propagate through the universe at the kind of speed of light, right?
Yeah.
So the way in which those masses are bending the universe around them, as they move, that bending will also kind of move outward through the universe, and that will start to look like a wave.
Like a ripple.
Like a ripple, yes. And so those ripples are what we're trying to detect with LIGO in Eastern Washington and in Louisiana, and there's several other experiments across the world. And so those waves do exist. We can try and measure from, you know, things like the distances of mirrors here on Earth. We can tell when there are really massive objects moving around in space far away from us. So those objects will create distortions in space that we could actually measure here on Earth. But, right, so gravity waves, very, very real. Being able to create gravity waves by playing these light harpy looking things in the middle of a tesseract and having that affect dust or like make the watch hand
Morse code.
Fluctuate
Morse code.
In Morse code. Yeah, that
how long did he have to be there to transmit all that like all that data through like dot dash dot? I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Makes no sense.
How that works.
Yeah.
That how we actually get from the existence of gravity waves to being able to do that, to be able to say, no, I want to move something in this part of the universe and from that cause this little watch hand to flicker in a way that's going to spell out something by Morse code. That's not really feasible.
At this moment, right? I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's not feasible at this moment to also totally measure a gravity wave yet, which we're getting close.
We are getting close.
Which I've been told like every 10 years. So.
Right.
I don't know.
There's those ice clouds were bananas.
Yeah.
Whoa.
They were, though.
Yeah.
They made no sense.
Right. And then there was the ocean world where the time dilation did happen. And then what was the other one? It was just kind of like a Mars-y looking place.
Yeah. Really cold.
Hoth.
Well, no. The cold place was the ice planet.
You're talking about the last planet.
The last planet.
Where they saw her for a second. They're like, you got to go to her. That one.
Oh,
yeah.
Did she go there alone?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, because they found Matt Damon on the other one.
Matt Damon. Right. We've talked about Matt Damon in this episode. I want to thank you, Kevin, for talking to us about a movie that we kind of all watched and talked about and we've been asked about. But thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and hopefully we can see you again maybe sometime talking about more.
That would be great. That'd be fun. Thank you.
This show was recorded at Spark Museum on Bay Street in the heart of Bellingham. Our producers are Suzanne Blaze and Katie Knutson. Theme music by Chemical Calisthenics by Blackalicious and Wonderland by Janelle Monáe.
Our feature song today is Space Oddity by David Bowie. Join us again next week at this time. If you like our show and would love to support us, please go to KMRE.org and click on the button Donate.
Neutron, proton, mass defect, lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, transuranium, if y'all was uranium, molecules, spontaneous combustion, bah! Law of definite proportion, gain anyway, I'm every element around. Lead, gold, tin, iron, platinum, zinc. When I rap, you think iodine, nitrate, activate. Right, uranium, the only difference is I transmit sound. Balance with some balance, then you add a little talent in. Careful with those ingredients. They can explode and blow up if you drop them and they hit the ground.